Thank you very much, Doug. Thanks also to the network and to Cordaid for putting this event on, and for Cordaid also for sponsoring the work that me and my colleagues, a team that includes researchers from the University of Notre Dame, have been doing over the last year, drilling down on the issue of how civil society organizations have been affected by counterterrorism measures, particularly since 9/11, 2001. And in order to sort of frame the context of this, we tried to define what counterterrorism measures are. There are a full and very large array of counterterrorism measures out there, and we, not to be coy, tried to classify them into three broad categories. One would be the good, the second, the bad, and the third, the ugly. And the good counterterrorism measures, I should also mention, these all sort of feed into each other, unfortunately. The good measures are those that pay attention to human rights. I think we all start with the premise that there is some necessity, of course, to protect citizens from terrorism. The reaction after 9/11, after 7/7 in the UK, Spain, and an array of other attacks obviously necessitate some measures taken by the state to prevent terrorism. The good category were those undertaken in a multilateral fashion by the United Nations, those that have developed over time to also look at development issues, to look at these sort of so-called root causes. And with the most important factor is that they pay strict attention to human rights, promoting human rights, due process, and other elements. The bad category are those that may not have intended negative consequences, but through certain legislative measures, they've closed the space for civil society organizations to operate. They've hampered the funding streams that have come to them. And also, they've diverted money away for longer-term issues such as development and education, which are a fundamental part of building a healthy and strong civil society and good governance. And then the third is the ugly category, and that are those the measures that are just out and out repressive. Those are the ones that exercise authority using extrajudicial killings. Those are the ones that round up CSOs and try to connect them with terrorist, so-called terrorist groups, without providing any evidence whatsoever. And in many cases, special laws have been implemented. A couple I'll just give you as examples. In Ethiopia, in Uganda, where they've been very repressive on the extent to which CSOs can even operate. And this presents a glaring contradiction, because as we know, and has been acknowledged with the sort of rise of what some governments are calling radicalization, youths in Leeds in northern England, then coming down to London and blowing up buses and what have you, has all been seen as a sort of process of radicalization. And the way to defeat radicalization is to look at preventing terrorism on the preventive end. And that means to ensure that people have access to education, that people do not feel politically marginalized, they do not have grievances because of human rights. And civil society organizations are absolutely vital to ensuring that happens. And the contradiction we've seen is that states, by implementing these, particularly the bad and the ugly measures, are closing the space of civil society and really disrupting their ability to operate effectively. There are some good signs. I mean, in the United Nations, there is a recognition since 2006 that the root causes have to be dealt with. The United Nations counterterrorism strategy was developed with four pillars. One of those pillars focused on what in UN parlance is referred to as the causes conducive to the spread of terrorism, sometimes referred to as the root causes. So they ensure that education and development and other things are part of that strategy. The second and third pillars deal with a sort of run-of-the-mill counterterrorism measures that were implemented by the Security Council and the ability to build capacity for those after 9/11. And then the fourth pillar is human rights. So as a package and on paper, it's a wonderful concept. We've also seen the same thing happen with security sector reform, where the United Nations, the OECD, the Development Assistance Committee, and others have recognized that security sector reform, counterterrorism measures need to have these elements of human rights built into them. This is all on paper, as I say. There are some good practices out there, and I can illustrate a couple of them where, for example, an African security sector network has been set up with the funds that have been used to beef up security in around Africa, often provided by former colonial powers like the UK. Now there's an understanding that there has to be a role for civil society organizations as well, and they're playing more of an active role. But unfortunately, the good practices are very, very few and far between. More often than not, you're seeing, unfortunately, what are promulgated as good the good practices at the UN are then being interpreted by national governments as this gives us carte blanche to do what we want in the name of preventing terrorism. And what we have today here is an ability to give us some context from each of the different cases that will be presented from Colombia, from Palestine. We also have a colleague from the Philippines who might be able to add something as well, to give specific examples of what I have just outlined in a very general way. Thank you.